Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There was a recent poll done. There have been a lot of these polls, but this one caught our attention, talking to people over the age of 40 about how they are preparing for old age. And it was found that most people have done little to no planning. 3 in 10 would rather not think about getting older at all. I fully understand that. Only a quarter predict it's very likely that they'll need help in getting around caring for themselves during their senior years. And it is a surprising poll, considering that the poll found that more than half of the 40-plus crowd had already been caregivers for an impaired friend or relative, seeing from the other side the kind of assistance that they, too, are likely to need later on. So this hour, we're going to take care of all of that. We're going to be talking about aging with dignity and independence and the kinds of plans that need to be made. How to prepare to be older in this society, because that's what is happening. We're getting older, of course. Dr. Bruce Chernoff is our guest this hour, president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation. They have studied this, and they have released 10 things you can do to support aging with dignity and independence. We'll put that on our Facebook page if that's a possibility. After the show. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. I would imagine that we'll have many on this issue because there's a lot to examine. And we'll do it with Dr. Chernoff and you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Bruce Chernoff, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's a real pleasure to join you today.
So we really don't want to think about getting older, huh?
No, it's not top of mind for most of us, even though most of us have had some experience caring for a loved one, a friend, or a family member.
And why is that? Is it just that we're in this society that you watch television and you've got this youthful thing going on in the ads, people are youthful, and we prize it so much in this society?
Well, I do think that that's part of it, that as a society we value that sense of youth and that sense of being able to do everything we want to do across the course of our lives. And actually, I think rather than trying to push back on that, which a lot of policy thinking has tried to do, tried to have a discussion about dying a good death, tried to have a discussion in very medicalized terms, I actually don't think that's the way to engage the public. So while I get that people don't want to think about this, I don't think we've talked with the general public about this in a way that really makes sense to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a physician, I like to say that, I was trained as a doctor to write my medical notes to say, this 79-year-old hypertensive diabetic COPD or with heart disease, I've never received a Christmas card from a patient that had it addressed to me that way.
Right.
Your loving patient.
Right.
Da, 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 da. Or and candidly, I've never seen a tombstone that has people categorize their life that way. I mean, we tend to think of ourselves in terms of the function and independence we have.
Mm-hmm.
And even older folks with really substantial needs don't define themselves by the function that they lost. They define themselves by the function they retain. So I think we need to begin a different kind of discussion, because all of us are likely to need some form of long-term services and supports as we age.
Right. And you would think that we would know that, because most of us in the baby boom generation have had to take care in some way of our parents, and we have had a firsthand look at how you have to navigate a nursing home, or if a stroke or a heart attack happens and you're old and you don't have that much time left, how much Medicare pays for and the supplemental insurance and long-term care and all of that. I'm just astounded how complicated that can be.
Well, you are absolutely right. It's incredibly complicated, and for most of us, we don't encounter that complexity until it's right in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
Starts with that phone call in the middle of the night. Mom's in the emergency room. She broke her hip, and you can just hear the voice trailing off. And that's our first moment for many of us who are boomers. It's our first interaction with that whole part of the delivery system. And candidly, that part of the delivery system has never been developed in kind of a thoughtful, integrated way. I think most people would say, oh my gosh, I thought it would be so much easier. I can't believe it's so complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's largely because we've not really thought about it in an organized way. And we all sort of encounter it out of the blue in a kind of a fire drill moment. And that's not, you know, that's one of the other really important points of the poll, is that's not what people want. I mean, people want and expect there to be a more organized approach when those needs come, and it's just not there. And that really catches people off guard.
So we went, as you well know, through this huge, long debate about healthcare reform in this country, and we have a plan that people are still fighting about. But long-term care and what happens at that point as you get older and you want to have a vital life, really, it appears to me, has still not been developed. So as a society, what do we need to do to pay attention to that?
That's, a terrific question. Why I love sitting and talking with somebody like you about this topic, because I think helping the American public and all your wonderful listeners in Wisconsin begin to think about these reasons is key to having a good discussion. So I think the first really important point is there is this common misconception that we need to address. And that common misconception is, well, gosh, I'm not likely to need this. But the reality is there's very good data that shows that 70% of people over the age of 65 will need some form of long-term services and supports as they age.
70%, that bears repeating.
70%.
That's a lot.
Yep. And on average, they're going to need it for 3 years. Now, I'm not talking about being in a nursing home. Let's be clear. For a percentage of those people, it is about being in a nursing home. But for the vast majority of people, it's about a little bit of help to dress, or a little bit of help to cook or get to the supermarket. So it isn't necessarily the thing that scares people the most, I think. And while, nursing homes in general have come a really long way, there's been a great deal of culture change in nursing homes to try to improve the quality of care and experience. That is the thing that scares people the most. And I think what we need to help folks understand is almost all of us are going to need a little bit of help at some point. We're going to need it for a good period of time, 3 years, maybe more, and we need to plan for that. So that's the beginning of a more, informed discussion. From there, we need to help people understand and begin to talk with their families about what they want, how they want to go about living their lives should they have a little bit of need, and then to begin to study the resources that are and, frankly, are not available at this point. Mm-hmm. So a common misconception is that, well, you know, Medicare will pay for it when I get there.
Right.
And the reality is that's not what Medicare is built to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, beginning this discussion to help people understand that almost all of us are likely to have at least a little bit of need, and we need a plan for that as a society. Aging is not a partisan issue. It's not an independent Democrat or Republican issue. Aging is an issue that we will all face, and so we need a thoughtful plan to mm-hmm. help all of us when we get to that point.
So, Dr. Chernoff, what resources are not available now that need to be?
Well, I think that's a really important question, because the reality is, Medicare, as we've already said, Medicare really is not a payer of long-term care. They pay for a few things here and there right after somebody's in a hospital, but that's it. Medicaid pays for long-term care for people who've become really poor, but that means having essentially no personal resources left, save maybe a roof over your head. And so that leaves kind of the great middle. And there aren't many choices for people in the great middle. You can try to buy long-term care. Long-term care is not necessarily inexpensive, and it comes with underwriting. So that means if you have substantial medical problems, you may not qualify. So at this point, we really don't have much in the way of affordable and accessible choices. And that's really where public policy needs to go. Mm-hmm. We need to create a broader set of choices so that people during their working years can, you know, save, plan, insure, whatever the right solution is, but prepare for this need that we're all likely to have at some point.
Mm-hmm. I had a friend years ago, maybe we should have listened to her, who said, what we all need to do is get ourselves a nice piece of pretty land and at a certain point get together and take care of each other. It's not a bad idea, actually, is it?
Well, no, it's not. And I think part of this is planning. So I really, you know, one of the other important points of this poll is lots and lots of folks say, oh, yeah, my family is going to be there for me when the time comes. And about the same number of people, percentage of people in the poll said, and I've had no discussion with my family about
right,
it.
Right.
I mean, it's this total study in contrast, uh-huh. right? And I do think that we need to plan more realistically. And to your friend's example, there really is an opportunity to think differently about how we age, how communities age, how we support people aging in communities of their choice, and how do we add more connectivity to people's lives, and whether that's in urban environments. I could show you examples in really urban places like New York City, in really rural environments that provide all kinds of connectivity that help people age in community, in a community of their choice with appropriate supports. I mean, those are really good ideas, and they're part of the solve, but all those solves need to be paid for somehow. Mm-hmm. So there is both the process and systems of delivering that kind of community-based support, and then there's the ways that we need to fund it.
You talk about the fact that we all need to, we may, if we're lucky, we live to be older people, and that's all right. It's fine to have a vital older life. Old people are wise, and there's a lot of things that a lot of people can do when you are old, and you need to think about that, you recommend, where, how you will live as you grow older, what you might do in case you need daily support, somebody who can be your surrogate decision maker who will honor your health care wishes, have that conversation before you find yourself old with no plans at all.
Well, I think a little bit of planning goes a long way, and I think the discussion that we all should be having is, you know, how is it we want to live our lives?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of start with the idea that we all want to live our lives every day with as much function and independence. And candidly, I think all of us want the function, independence, and choice that we have today when we're 80 or 90.
Right.
And so I think a little bit of discussion with family in that kind of framework can go a really long way. And then you're completely correct that there are some good tools that are out there to help people document those desires, and they can be updated over time, just as one plans for the rest of their lives. People, we all think about things like life insurance and other kinds of things in our own lives to protect ourselves. So this sort of fits in that broader context of planning for ourselves and our families over time. But I think, you know, the tools support a good discussion and not the other way around. So the really beginning to talk with family and friends about what that circle of support will look like, should look like, that's a great place to start.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Dr. Bruce Chernoff is our guest, president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation. They do have, and we will put it on our Facebook page later, 10 things you can do to support aging with dignity and independence. So let's look at this whole issue. Do you feel reluctant to think about the fact that you're getting older? What about if you are getting older? Have you confronted that in some way? Have you said, that's all right, and here are the things that I need to do to make sure that if I need long-term care? I think that's a striking figure. Dr. Chernoff told us that 70% of people over 65 are going to need some kind of care for at least 3 years. That's a large chunk of the population. And do we have systems in place so that we can afford to have people care for us? What are those systems? How do we need to be thinking beyond what we have now, which doesn't seem to be sufficient for a lot of people? Why it is that we don't confront the fact that we're getting older, and indeed, as the baby boomers age, there will be a huge number of older people in this country for many, many years. Well, if you have some thoughtful, creative, interesting thoughts and recommendations on all of this, we would love to hear from you. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 855. Lines are completely open for you at this very moment. You can also always send us an email, and that is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page. We welcome your thoughts on Facebook as well, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Before we go to our phone calls, Dr. Chernoff, can you give us an indication of the numbers of older people we're going to have in this country? With the baby boom generation is getting old now, so what other statistics, and will they force a change because of the huge numbers of people who are old?
That's a terrific question. So the number of folks over the age of 65 is going to double over the next couple of decades. We're talking about tens of millions of people who are going to need care, and in an environment where the actual workforce will be getting smaller. I mean, the boomers will move demographically, kind of through the population, and we're going to need a completely different system of care. I think it's important to remember that in when Medicare and Medicaid were created, really the backbone of care for older individuals, and those older individuals, the Medicaid program for those who are poor, the average life expectancy was 69 years. And today, the average life expectancy is, for men and women together, is 78 years, approaching 79, and it's actually longer for women. So the reality is, over the past 50 years or so, we've seen life expectancy increase, really through the tremendous changes that modern medicine has wrought, both treatments and medications. It's amazing that we've increased life expectancy so much, but that increased life expectancy has come with an increased likelihood that we're going to live with a little bit of need or more.
Mm-hmm.
In 1965, if you had a major stroke or major heart attack, there weren't that many things that we could offer you in medicine. There weren't ICUs and CCUs in every local hospital. And the kinds of modern treatments we have today didn't exist. So you're far more likely, as an older person, to survive a major serious event than you were 50 years ago. But you also stand a higher likelihood of having some functional limitations at some point related to some of those problems. And therein is the challenge.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. Bill in Tomahawk. Hi.
Hi. I've been listening to the debate, and recently I saw the healthcare stats for the cost of American medicine per person compared to our nearest competitor, and it was more than double. And the statistics for the delivery of health care don't back up that cost, first of all. Second of all, I'm an RN, and I think that anybody that's working in the system that's taking down more than a livable wage needs to think about what they're doing and how much money they're taking out of the system. And I'll listen for the comment.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, first, let me thank that caller. I think as a country, we need more nurses, we need more RNs, and it's a really, really important profession, and particularly as we age, it's one of those shortage areas that we need to work on as a country. With respect to the caller's questions and points, which are really good and I completely agree with, the shocking thing for us as a country is we spend more than almost, than any other industrialized country on healthcare. And candidly, the quality of our care, when you look at it at a population level, isn't as good as many other countries. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have really advanced treatments here and that we can't do really amazing things person by person, circumstance by circumstance. But I think we're not getting all the value that we deserve as a country for the money that we're spending. And a lot of that is because the system is so fragmented. And so I bet that many of your callers have had the experience of caring for somebody with serious chronic illness or functional limitations and found themselves sort of up a tree. One doctor is not talking to another. the people in the hospital aren't talking to the people in the community. The people in the community can't get folks to call them back when they have a care question. Oftentimes, the care coordination falls on the shoulders of family members, a spouse who may be sick themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's that fragmentation that really results in the high cost of care and the low quality. And I think we all do experience it. I mean, I have an adopted 97-year-old grandmother who I look in on frequently, and I'm one of her primary caregivers.
Oh.
And even as a doctor, it can be really challenging sometimes. So that's an argument for a better model of care, one that we don't really have today in this country.
So what is that model, and how do we get it?
It's a great question. So from my perspective, there is a ring of connectivity that's sort of missing in healthcare right now, which we as a foundation really believe needs to be developed. And that ring of connectivity would do a few key things. First of all, it would help us really understand what seniors want and need and desire. So that family discussion that we were talking about before the break, that's a really important piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
From that would come a single plan of care that the patient and the family, the person in the family, would have input in, and that all the providers would understand what's in that plan of care, that there would be real care coordination, so that something to help break down that fragmentation in those silos, so that every person would have a single point of contact that could help them navigate the system. And that includes both the medical system, but also the support system in the community. So for the subset of seniors who really have reached the point where they're vulnerable to some degree, where they need a little bit of help on a regular basis, that we have a new level of support and understanding for their needs. And believe it or not, that actually would make the system more efficient, it would improve quality, and probably, in the long run, save money. There are many examples where those systems are actually more effective and more efficient.
Let's go to Barb in Spring Green. Oh, Barb, I hope I still have you. Hi, Barb. Oh, darn. Please call back, Barb. Are you there? I'm sorry. I pressed the wrong darn button. So call us back, Barb, because we'd like to hear from you. Nancy in Minocqua. Hi.
Hi, yes. As an insurance agent, there are so many people that are under the illusion that long-term care insurance and home health insurance are just so expensive. They don't really want to sit down and talk to anybody because they think they're just going to be paying so much money for it, when actually it helps the system, helps them keep their assets, helps them stay off of Medicaid, which helps the government.
But wouldn't you agree, Nancy, that it is pretty expensive?
It's not really. It really isn't. You'd be very surprised if you actually sat down with someone that has the coverage and shows you what it is for what you're paying for something that 70% of the population is going to need. You actually waste more money on home insurance and car insurance because you have less claims on your home and less claims on your car.
Dr. Chernoff.
So I think that's a good point. I will say that I do think that for many people, long-term care insurance may be more expensive than they can handle at a given point in time. And I would, you know, love to see more people have some kind of long-term care insurance coverage, because I do think that the more people who participate, ultimately that helps bring costs down for everybody. And I think it's something that everybody should explore. So, it's one of those things where long-term care insurance is potentially a solve for a large number of people. But like I said earlier, you know, for many people, it may be out of reach, either because they have underlying medical problems or because their personal economic circumstances don't quite let them get there. But I think until you sit down with somebody, with an insurance agent, and really look at all your options and balance the kinds of insurances you need in your life for yourself, your family, your kids, whatnot, you don't really know. So where I would agree with our caller is that it is worth having the discussion to at least know what all your options are.
And that discussion should take place when you're how old?
You know, I think that it's a discussion that all of us should be having, but certainly, I think as people look at their 40s, that's a good time to start having that discussion, and certainly by 50, it's very important that you have that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And at least assess whether it makes sense for you. You know, I think that we've done a good job helping people think about life insurance across their lives, and for some people, disability insurance, either personally or through work, so it fits in that discussion. And I think having it as part of that discussion is really important. The last really important important thing before we move on, is that there are some new and interesting products out there, which our last caller didn't raise, but I would raise for your listeners, is we're starting to see products that allow you to balance, say, life insurance and disability insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Life insurance and disability insurance, and relative to this discussion, life insurance and long-term care insurance together, so that you know you could leverage the benefit when you need it in ways you need it, and those may make a lot more sense in folks' lives. Now, I don't know the Wisconsin insurance market at that level of detail, but I think for your listeners, it would be worth exploring to see if those kinds of products are available, because they give you a whole lot more flexibility.
Yes. And they are available. I'm aware of them. They're available. Here's an email from Elizabeth. I find this subject very interesting today as I just turned 40 last month. I can tell I'm slowing down, although still feel young, Elizabeth. Don't worry, you're very young. I finally decided to start a 401k last year, and I did the max of 6% that my employer would match, and that is all I have going. What do you have to say, doctor, about that? Should I be doing more? And then she says, I wish I would have started all of this at the age of 20.
So this is a great email and something for all of us and all of the listeners who are with us today to give some thought to. You know, it is shocking how many people are retiring today on their Social Security savings alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a small amount of money to cover your basic living needs before you have a long-term care or long-term services and supports need. And, you know, that represents an additional cost above just the basics, like food, you know, roof over our heads, heating in the winter, basic transportation. So economic planning is a big piece of complete planning as we age. The other really important thing to realize is, you know, right now, more than 50% of people, when they retire, have less than $25,000 in savings.
Really?
That is very little. And
right.
You know, 1 year in a nursing home is in the range of $70,000 or $80,000. So you can sort of see that a small amount of savings can evaporate very quickly in the care of a family member who needs long-term services and supports. I do think that as we come out of the really difficult economic times that we've been in, which has been hard on many families, it is really important for us to revisit our savings opportunities, you know, 401ks and those sorts of things. It's always a good idea to put as much money away as possible in those opportunities. And to the degree that people who are listening in have employer matches through their work, that's money that you take with you into retirement above and beyond your salary. Always a good idea to try to pull that in. It's hard. People have to balance their needs today with their planning for the future. I totally understand that. But I do think that that part of financial planning is really helpful and will help people when they get to their latter years where they're going to need to pay for additional services. I also think, though, going back to the previous discussion, it's worth talking a little bit with your both your employer, looking at benefits that you may have available to you or through your insurance agent, about whether there may be some choices, low-cost choices that may make sense and give you a little bit of coverage later on when you might need it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Carl in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hello. Listening to the conversation, I've been in a situation. My mom passed away when she was in her 40s of a heart condition, mm-hmm. hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and the woman who helped her pass on, that was back in 1979, just in recent years, developed ovarian cancer and other forms of cancer and decided that the chemo route was making her feel just so sick, and she just decided to spend the remaining time that she had in her own home with her friends around her. And I was there for a month and was her primary person besides hospice care. And the end of her life taught me a lot about what it means to be alive and what it means to move on into death. And I just wonder if our conversation nationally, as we talk about this, is very scientific and very fearful of passing on, of aging, as of getting old, of being vulnerable, and that we aren't, you know, perhaps we're in a position where we've got the ability, because we can, to sustain people's lives, you know, into, as you say, a decade or more beyond what we were able to do just recently. But then the quality of that life and the way that life plays out toward the end, we may not be getting exactly what it is we're hoping to achieve. And I'd just like the doctor's thoughts on that.
So this is this caller's comments really goes to the heart of why the foundation I run was created and the work that we do, because it really is all about aging with dignity and independence. You know, and I feel comfortable saying, as a physician, having practiced for many years before being in this role, you know, we tend to worry a lot about quality of health, and so much of what we've been built is in this really kind of scientific structure, and that's important. We want good quality care when we need it, and to the degree we have something that can be cured, we want it cured. But what we've neglected, I think, is to engage a thoughtful discussion about quality of life. And I think one of the things that's incumbent upon all healthcare providers, starting with doctors, is to begin a different kind of discussion with folks. So I grew up in a family where my father was a doctor. He was an oncologist, and I watched him practice over three decades. And, you know, he was really good at talking with families about the trade-offs between really strong chemotherapeutic agents and, you know, potentially being quite sick and losing hair and needing to be in the hospital and whatnot, and the likelihood that those treatments would actually provide a cure or a bit of a remission for a period of time, and helping people think about sort of what the balance is between quality of life and quality of health. We have so many more choices now available to us that may increase, you know, the number of days of life a little bit, days, weeks, months, but they don't necessarily do that by delivering increased quality of life. And so I think that kind of discussion, your caller is completely right, that balances those, and that frankly doesn't medicalize people's day-to-day lives. I mean, we're only a patient when we're in the hospital or when we're in the doctor's office. And I think we want to live our lives as people, not patients.
Yes.
For every person, it's different, right? And helping everybody make the right decision is very important. There isn't a one-size-fits-all answer, but as the caller was suggesting, I think that engaging in this kind of quality-of-life discussion, a really informed discussion, that's where we need to be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Carl, so much for your call. And for being a good person, too. Here's an email. I love this email from Sarah in Madison. I just returned from a 31st annual reunion with 14 well-read, politically and socially active women. We raised our children together. We've suffered and rejoiced together. We are 62 to 74 years old with varying incomes. The conversations are always intense and exploratory. This year, the theme seemed to center around aging and vitality. We had 17 magazine for adolescent years, our bodies ourselves as young mothers, ourselves growing older, and now what? We talked about writing a book about this stage of life. I think they should. Since none seems to fit the bill, will we have health insurance, invigorating activities, nurturing end-of-life care? Suddenly, we are our parents. It's an all-consuming, intriguing subject. We came to no conclusions, but the discussion continues on emails. What a great email that is.
Yeah, it's really fabulous. And it's one of the things that kind of gives me hope as we do our work, because I think, you know, it's these kinds of groups of friends, these kinds of communities, these kinds of connections where people will come together and change the way we think about aging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if we're going to wait for the medical system to fix this, I feel very comfortable saying this as a doctor. If we think we're going to wait for the medical system to fix this, we're kidding ourselves. And I think that all of us, as we approach retirement or are in retirement, you know, need to make the case for dignity, independence, and choice, and living life to the fullest, and in ways that we value. Because at the end of the day, you know, what we take with us is our friends, is our family,
yes,
is the communities we live in. And when I listen to that description, what I hear is a group of women who are still changing the face of the communities they live in. They're still a vital force in their families. They're still a vital force in important issues, and they should be. And that's what we should be gunning for.
Yes.
That's what we should be gunning for. And those are the kinds of activities, that kind of quality of life, quality of community, quality of choice and dignity discussion, that is how we will reshape aging.
Mm-hmm.
And we will push back on the medical system to think differently about how it engages community-based services.
And I say, in all seriousness, Sarah, I think you and the group of women that you've been meeting with should write a book on this. I think it would be terrific. And I'm wondering, Dr. Chernoff, have you written a book on all of this?
You know, I've not. It's one of those things that I would love to do. We do a lot of writing here at the Foundation, and I do a lot of writing on behalf of the Foundation. But it's a great idea. And
yes.
So if that group of women puts together that book, have them email me, and we'll write the introduction or forward for them. How's
there
that?
You go. We really got something done today. I like this.
I love it.
Yeah. Let's go next to Greg in Lombard, Illinois. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Kathleen, and as usual, an excellent show. Quite frankly, I think you need to bring your guests back, and because I think this is a big discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to give you an actually, your guest kind of preempted me to the man to guests back. You know, I think in this country we are afraid to face death. It's inevitable. And my understanding is we spend the bulk of our health care trying to extend lives in the last 3 years. And I believe that's essentially true. But here's my personal point. We have wonder drugs. We can do all kinds of things. What is wrong with medicine? I understand the Hippocratic Oath, but what is wrong with alleviating suffering and not subjecting people like myself? I'm in my 60s. I don't want to have people changing my diapers. I don't want people giving me baby food. I want to make a decision, and I don't want to have to use a pistol or carbon monoxide in the garage. Why can't we do better than that for people that decide that?
Dr. Chernoff.
So, a really tough question, and one that we all
mm-hmm.
think about. Let me sort of start with the caller's first point, because he's correct, and I think it's a real challenge. So we do spend an enormous amount of money at the end of life. It's something that gets talked about a lot. I think the challenge is, as a doctor, this is a question that I used to get asked all the time when I was still in full-time practice, is, so, Doc, how long do I have to live? It's sort of that question. And the challenge is none of us as doctors really know when 6 months or a year is left. In medical school, they don't give us a little meter that helps us do that kind of an assessment. So it's easy in retrospect to say, oh, boy, we spent a whole lot of time and a whole lot of money. And actually, maybe created a whole bunch of discomfort in the process that somebody may not have actually wanted, you know, in the process of getting to end of life. So I think that the kind of challenge here is that we're never going to be able for most people to say specifically how long they have left to live. And what needs to occur is a much better discussion about how we want to live. What I liked about what your caller said in the middle part of his comments is that, you know, here's somebody with a really clear vision about what he wants. And that's the kind of thing that needs to be expressed to family members. And again, you know, there are some tools to help document what people do and don't want, but it's more than just those tools. It's sort of an understanding amongst family and friends about how we want to live our lives. And it's a regular discussion that we should be having with our doctors, because things change over time. You know, Kathleen, you might have that discussion with me today, and a year from now you might feel differently. So it's not static, right? Things do change. So I think having a good discussion about quality of life and trade-offs, not in the moment of crisis, not in the ICU, but, you know, as things are evolving over time, is the kind of healthy discussion we all should be having. And it takes some of the pressure off when we get to a moment of crisis. I think your caller's last point is an important one, which is, you know, there are programs in the United States that are there to really relieve suffering. And the best way that the medical system has to relieve suffering is through the hospice program. Hospice provides pain relief and symptom relief through the last 6 months of life. But sadly, most Americans, if they actually get enrolled in hospice, are in it a very short period of time, a few days to a week. So we are completely underutilizing the resources that are there, you know, to help people when they are at a point where managing symptoms is the most important thing to do. And I think it sort of backs into the previous point, which is we aren't ready yet to have those discussions, and we should be. We should be having those discussions about what we want, and that we shouldn't be afraid of having them.
Right, right. I mean, it's a very natural part of life, right? You're born and you die.
It is a natural part of life, and you know, I look at how much obstetrical care has changed over the last 20 or 30 years. So when I was a medical school student, you know, we were trained, you know, that you delivered all babies in hospitals, and it was very sterile and very antiseptic, and the whole system was sort of set up for the benefit of when the doctors were available and on call, and it was very medical. And, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years, women have really pushed back on that concept, and there's many more choices for women, particularly for women. You know, being pregnant is a state of health. It's not a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the whole process of obstetrics has really changed. I mean, yes, there are high-risk deliveries, and yes, those have really medical implications. We need to do the same thing in aging, where we think differently about what it means to have a chronic illness and some functional limitations, but want to live our whole lives as people, not patients, right?
Right.
So that's the discussion we need to have.
Yeah, I like that phrase, people, not patients. I want to go back to, and we'll do this in a moment, those people who will need, and most of us have had experience, we'll have it with ourselves, but we've had it with our parents, that they may need some kind of help, going to the grocery store, cooking, dressing, maybe attending to medical needs, but they're not major. And what system is in place to do that? I want to ask Dr. Chernoff about that, because I think that's a huge need in this country, and particularly with so many families being separated by huge distances, why we can't fill that need, which I think is omnipresent. And we're welcoming more of your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during, tomorrow's our One Day Wednesday, and I urge you to pledge your support for Wisconsin Public Radio tomorrow. We like doing these. It's just a day. We're still going to have informational shows for you and entertaining shows, and then we move on. So tomorrow, during this time period, we'll be playing some of our favorite interviews, excerpts from those interviews, because I think it's remarkable what we talk about in the course of a day, to say nothing of a week and a month. It's just incredible. And we'll do kind of an all things political segment the first hour of our program. So One Day Wednesday tomorrow, please pledge, and we thank you. Our guest this hour is Dr. Bruce Chernoff, president and CEO of the SCAN Foundation. We're talking as a society and as individuals what we need to do to age and remain people and not patients, and where we're falling short, both as a society and as people. Let me, before we go back to our many phone calls, Dr. Chernoff, return to those people, because I think you rang a bell when you said we will need maybe some help dressing, cooking, maybe going to the supermarket, maybe tending to some minor medical needs. What systems are in place for that? It seems to me as though that's a real, real need in this country.
So you're completely right. It is a real need in this country, and I think you know, the challenge in front of us is that there are resources out there. They're just hard to find.
Yes.
And sometimes they have waiting lists. And going back to the very beginning of our discussion, you know, for many people, the first time you encounter this very fragmented system is in you know, an emergent situation, and it almost always starts with that phone call. It comes as a surprise. You know, it's that phone call in the middle of the night.
Yes.
It's that, you know, or the hospital calls and says, okay, it's time for mom to come home, and the hospital has done nothing to really think about. They may have done a great job on the healthcare piece, but mm-hmm. they fail to realize that actually mom lives on the second floor of an apartment that will, and she'll need to walk up because there's no elevator, but she now can't walk up those stairs because of what happened to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is surprising and saddening to me as a physician, you know, how far we have to go. So I think that there are some things that people can do now, simple things to start to plan for that potential need, since we've talked about the fact that many of us, most of us, are going to have some kind of a need. Good places to start is just to look around your own community, identify what some of the stronger resources may be, and resources that are stronger for you. So one resource that may be great for me may not be the best resource for you, or may not be the best resource for your next-door neighbor. Good places to start include what are called area agencies on aging. Some communities have what are called aging and disability resource centers, and those are places that you can go to get free, impartial advice. They can provide you guidance about the kinds of specific services that are available in a community. So if somebody needed help with things like food, Meals on Wheels, or transportation, they might be able to direct you to low or no-cost resources. In some cases, these organizations actually can provide a little bit of care coordination, particularly the aging and disability resource centers. So they're worth talking to because they may have a little more available. There are other good choices. Senior centers and community centers often have programs that help folks remain independent in
yes.
their communities, and it's good to know what's there. Faith-based organizations often play an important role in communities, and it's funny, I talk to many people who are involved in, you know, their churches or temples and not really understand. You know, you may be so engaged in the activities of church or temple related to your children that you may not have a great feeling for all the senior services, things that are available.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of reaching back into the faith-based communities around your listeners may be another important resource. Again, and then finally, I actually think it's always good to talk with your doctor about the resources and choices that may be available. So there are times when the medical system itself can provide either guidance to that kind of support or a little bit of help. Some hospitals have programs, for example. But I think the key thing is have those discussions now. You know, I think the idea is figure out which things are in your community, give them a call. Find out what they have available, experience what it's like to call them. Are there a waiting list for services? Do they cost anything? And just the experience of having dialed those phone numbers, talk with those people, will help you plan for the eventual call that you may get from mom or dad that
right.
we all should be prepared for.
Yeah. We only have about 40 seconds left, but Dee and Amory, hi.
Hi. There's quite a few agencies in our area that deal with home health care. Most of them don't have a waiting list, although some of them are pretty expensive if, you know, people are on a limited income. And what I've been doing is I've been doing personal cares for the elderly, and mostly by word of mouth. The woman that does discharge planning at the hospital has my name and number and knows what kinds of things I can do and am willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have had a lot of clients or customers, whatever, by word of mouth, because someone knew I was taking care of that person and they
mm-hmm.
referred them.
Hmm. Well, that's filling a need, but you wish a system were in place for that kind of thing, don't you, Dr. Chernoff?
Yeah, I think this is such a nice call
yes.
for us to come to wrap up on, because I do think that both paid and unpaid caregivers in the home are a huge piece of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're, and because we're going to need a little bit of help to help us remain people, not patients.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having a more robust system that supports both paid and unpaid caregivers, family caregivers, both in terms of helping identify the right safe people to be in the homes of vulnerable seniors and to help those people have appropriate skills so they can do things like lift and transfer safely, to help provide respite care to families when they need to be able to travel or go away. This is a really important
yes.
puzzle. It really is.
Dr. Chernoff, thank you so much. You've been a wealth of information. Please return.
I'll come back anytime.
Thank you. Dr. Bruce Chernoff, President and CEO of the SCAN Foundation. Obviously, a conversation that is important. Tons of phone calls. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. Write that book. The book is needed. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks to Rob Ferret for producing the program. And we'll be with you tomorrow.